welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we've just come back from the Liberal Democrats Party conference in Bournemouth. As part of our quest to find out just how well equipped the political parties in the UK are to make sure we play a leading role in the battle against climate change. Over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at the Greens, Tories and Labour, but we start with the Lib Dems, who are regarded by environmental campaign groups in the UK as having the best set of policies on climate change. A few weeks ago, Green NGOs released the latest edition of their annual Green Standard report, commenting once again on the highs and lows of the main three parties' climate policies. The Lib Dems are given credit for their efforts to strengthen the climate change bill, and for their recent commitment to make the UK energy independent by 2050, which builds on an earlier policy paper setting out how they would achieve a zero carbon Britain by 2050. There was concern, however, about whether Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg had downgraded the profile of their environmental commitments recently in the face of the economic downturn. I spoke to Steve Webb, Shadow Environment Secretary, and Norman Baker, Shadow Treasury Secretary. I started by asking Steve Webb about the current status of the government's climate change bill.
Well, the state of play is that we'll have a vote in the middle of October on my amendment to make the target 80% for 2050. Yeah. There's over 80 Labour MPs have signed an earlier amendment with exactly the same effect. Yeah. So hopefully, if they don't mind that it's a Liberal Democrat who's tabled it and vote for it because they believe in it, we'll have those 80 Labour MPs. The Conservatives have been abstaining so far. If the Conservatives plus the Lib Dems plus the Labour rebels voted for 80, it would win.
Okay. Not looking good for the Tories on that one.
I mean, they have an excuse for abstaining, saying they want this independent committee to recommend a number and then they take its advice, but we just want to get on with it.
I mean, there's a number of significant flaws that remain in the bill. So I'm wondering if you were able to put some more amendments in to make sure that this bill is really tight. Are you going to continue pushing aviation and shipping? That's included in the bill?
We've tabled an amendment on aviation and shipping because the way the bill stands, the government has an obligation to include it within 5 years, except it can, after 5 years, say it's all terribly difficult and we couldn't do it. So we think that's wrong. We think that there's enough ways already of measuring aviation and shipping emissions, more or less, and so we put an amendment in that gets rid of this opt-out clause. Again, we're probably not going to win on all of these things because the government has a majority in the Commons and force some of them through, but aviation and shipping is clearly another one of the big ones.
And another big one is the kind of get-out clause that remains in the bill. At the moment, the government doesn't have to make any emissions cuts at home at all. They can buy their entire emissions cuts from supposed savings abroad, which has lots of problems with verification and additionality. Now, you tabled an amendment in the House of Lords which got taken out by the government. You're going to put that back in, and what kind of cap are you looking for?
Well, we certainly think that we need to be getting on the road to a low-carbon economy here in the UK, so simply buying in your savings isn't acceptable.
It's not showing much leadership.
It's not showing leadership, that's right. And the amendment in the Lords was for 70% minimum at home, which the government have taken out. So we've tabled one for 50%, not because we think that's the right answer, but we want to get an establishment of the principle that even the majority of what's done has to be done at home. And if they won't even accept that, well, we sort of despair, really.
OK, that's quite a big opt-out. I mean, it's a bit disappointing to hear that, in a sense.
The reason we haven't just put 70 back in again is because we don't get to choose which amendments are debated. The Speaker of the House of Commons decides that. And one of the criteria they use is if it's already been talked about a lot, we don't talk about it again. So because we've already had a debate on 70% and there's been a vote, we may not get a chance to vote on 70 again, so we had to put something in.
Wouldn't that rule out 80% in shipping and aviation?
Well, what we've been advised is that something that's absolutely seen as central, top issue of the lot, we might get another go at, but we can't have another go at everything, so we've had to prioritise.
Last year, the Lib Dems agreed a policy document called Zero Carbon Britain, laying out a strategy for achieving a zero carbon Britain by 2050, without nuclear energy. The name of the document has been lifted from a report issued a few months earlier by the Centre for Alternative Technology, which showed that Britain can be carbon-free by 2027 with sufficient political will. While the Lib Dems stole the report's title, they have not adopted all the policies, nor the 2027 target. They also used the phrase carbon-neutral Britain within the document, which suggests an additional weakening. A point I wanted to iron out with Steve Webb.
You've got a target for 2050 zero carbon Britain. which is a great headline, but you use the phrase carbon neutral Britain as well, which implies that you would allow for buying emissions cuts from abroad and not making all those emissions cuts at home, and therefore it's not a zero carbon Britain.
I think the goal is to get Britain as close to zero carbon as is practically possible, whether it's possible to eliminate every possible source or whether there would be some offsetting.
You wouldn't want to strike out that wording because it does allow a lot of wriggle room. It would allow, for example, going along with the 50% opt-out that the government is possibly going to get with this current bill.
Well, I think the government doesn't accept any minimum, so I think they'll just throw that out and we'll vote that out. And the Liberal Democrat commitment is to get a zero carbon Britain. That's the goal. However, it may be that there are just residual things that it's either prohibitively expensive to do or just sort of, you know, just absolutely marginal. But the goal, you know, the goal is 100%. That's where we're heading for.
International policy, I'm wondering if you have much leverage in that area. Is it worth talking about even?
I
know you've got a contraction and convergence, I'm happy to see is in your policy.
Yeah, and the other advantage, of course, is Liberal Democrats are very influential in the European Parliament, where, you know, again, no one party has control, and so the Liberal group is a big one and has a big impact. So.
Is contraction and convergence having much traction as a policy idea within the EU?
It's something that we believe in, but there's such a diversity of opinion in the European Parliament. I don't think you could point to a specific measure. The renewables target is...
Are you pushing for that as an EU policy?
We're pushing at things that would head towards it, I think would probably be the best way to put it. So, for example, you know, we've endorsed the renewables targets and want to see them as tough as possible. We're working on things like carbon capture and trying to get that through. And so one of the dilemmas is that the practical politics of the European Union, you've got all sorts of national interests, industry interests, so, you know, you've got your goal, but you've also got the real politics of what you can achieve, and sometimes there's a gap between the two.
There was a climate clinic that was addressing the issue of a Kyoto 2 kind of deal. Was there anything important that came out of that for you in terms of how to kind of get this deal that we will need to kind of like avoid dangerous climate change at international level?
I think the key thing for me is that the pre-Copenhagen meeting in Poland, in Poznan, later this year, we will send the Environment Secretary, Hilary Benn, with a completed climate change bill from Britain. And if we can get that to be a tough, watertight bill, you know, with serious targets, no opt-outs, then he will have much more clout at the negotiating table to say, look, we've done this, you've got to. We're taking our share of the pain, you've got to. If we send in there with a weak bill, then that undermines the whole process.
Yeah. Again, I'm thinking about the 50% opt-out and thinking leadership.
No, I think you're getting hung up on this.
I think it's really important.
Of course it is, but what we're
saying is... It's either an 80% cut at home or a 40% cut at home, essentially.
Yes. I think that's
a big difference, and that's not taking leadership for developed countries.
I agree.
And it's not the kind of leadership that's going to avoid dangerous climate change.
I think, however, that there are two sorts of emission savings that you can buy in. I mean, there are sort of ones that are clearly not additional, ones that are unverified, but there are another set which, for example, could be within the European Union that you can clearly see are additional, that you can go and see and measure and test, which are making a contribution. And actually, some of the poorest countries in the EU may not afford these things themselves, and I don't think it's inherently wrong for Britain to be supporting those sorts of things as well. So I don't think spending money on genuine carbon savings elsewhere in the world is a bad thing. It mustn't stop us heading for a low carbon, zero carbon economy at home, but if that's something we do as well, for example, through international development spending, I think that's a good thing.
Okay. Jonathan Porritt mentioned something which I haven't been able to reference anywhere else. He said that Nick Clegg had signed up to a 350 million target for CO2.
Nick has had a meeting with James Hansen and was very, you know, impressed and convinced by the sorts of things he was saying. And clearly we take seriously the need to get on fast and not to sort of stabilise at these very high levels. And so we'll be working through detailed policy on these things.
350 parts per million is the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere that leading climate scientist James Hansen thinks is likely to be the upper limit of what will allow us to avoid dangerous climate change. In a Q&A debate on the environment at the Lib Dems conference, MEP Chris Davis said he couldn't deliver 350 in Europe because he would be told by other MEPs that our industries would collapse. James Hansen has been making the point repeatedly that a prerequisite of achieving the 350 target, and thereby avoiding dangerous climate change, is for developed countries to impose a ban on new coal-fired electricity plants that do not have full capture and storage technology.
And I guess we could go from that into coal.
Yep.
You're quoted here as saying we must halt the burning of the most polluting fossil fuels and introduce minimum efficiency standards on all energy generation. I understand also you've been arguing for an efficiency standard in the House of Commons.
In the energy bill, yeah.
You've been tabling amendments again on that. What kind of efficiency standard are you asking?
Well, an efficiency standard that would not allow the burning of unabated coal, for one.
400 or 500 grams per kilowatt hour?
From memory, it's certainly 400. Might even be less, and might even be 350. But the goal would be to say that, you know, it'd be the cleanest gas, and again, you want that abated as well. But the point being, you know, I think the Tories are talking about a cap that would actually still allow new coal, and we just don't think that's right.
So you're not getting support from the Tories on your amendment. What about Labour backbenchers?
We didn't at the time. I mean, what's interesting is when we proposed just the principle of an emissions standard, the Tories voted against us at the time. They've now adopted something similar as their own policy. So I think they're in a state of flux as well.
So they have an amendment down?
They do, actually, on the energy bill for minimum efficiency standards.
So could one of them get in?
It's not something that the Labour rebels have really caught on to, and without Labour rebels, we don't win.
But presumably, if between you and the Tories, if you came to an agreement, then there'd be a lot more support and possibility for getting through.
Not
even the Labour backbenchers and Tories and Lib Dems.
Labour rebels pick their issues. So if they were going to rebel on 80% or aviation and shipping, they wouldn't. You know, they will rebel once or twice, but not serially.
I guess the leadership issue on the environment was the big low that the Green Alliance pointed to in terms of the Lib Dems. Is it slipping down the agenda? Is it on the back burner because of the economy? Jonathan Porritt seemed to be very pointedly looking at you when he was saying that somebody had told him that recently.
No, I mean, it isn't, and that's one of our criticisms of the Green Standard Report, which is...
But you haven't said that to Jonathan Porritt?
No, sure. No, I mean, he was looking at me because I was the only Lib Dem person in the position of leadership in the room, but no,
so
I mean...
Some other Lib Dem might...
No, not at all. I mean, the commitment is there. One of the problems we've got with the report is, in a sense, some things tick boxes. So we did a launch on renewable energy, we likened it to the Apollo project, that got a big tick box. But in a sense, that was repeating policy we had already got. Whereas the work we've done on the climate change bill, although it's mentioned in the body of the report, the press headlines are, you know, nobody cares about the environment. But actually, we've spent hours behind the scenes in this work, which, if we get it through, will matter more than 1,000 Lib Dem policy documents. So I think to some extent, they're measuring slightly the wrong things.
You don't think you can sell the green message in times of an economic downturn?
Well, in some ways it's easier to sell because, you know, people appreciate the need to cut costs and on energy efficiency and so on. You've got an open door. And to be honest as well, with the whole potential of renewables growth, you know, for losing jobs in traditional manufacturing, renewables and so on is a potential growth area. So I think you have to sell it differently probably, but you can do it.
I mean, there are lots of benefits of low-carbon living, well-being, etc. But also, I mean, we've had some very frank assessments of the economy from Paddy Ashton, who's talking about peak oil on Question Time, saying that high oil prices are here to stay, let's get used to it, you know, this is a kind of ongoing long-term trend. Vince Cable predicting the collapse accurately of Northern Rock, I believe.
Yeah.
So there's been some frank assessments about that. Jonathan Porritt, again, saying that it's really unrealistic for any political party now to be selling the message that we can continue with the economic growth paradigm that we've had. So what do you make of all that?
I think that the way we think about the future has to be different to the way we've talked about the past. Now, whether that's looking at, you know, standard of living in a different way. I mean, in a sense, one of the challenges is how do you measure any of this? You know, we all know the things that are important in life, and most of them are very difficult to measure. On the other hand, governments live by, you know, targets and progress and how you assess them. So there's a whole set of issues about what you target. But I think everybody recognises you've got to look more broadly than GDP. You've got to look at carbon accounting much more. And I think that's the way, one of the things I've been saying a lot this week is, you know, you've got European carbon trading, you've got the carbon reduction commitment at home, there's going to be a carbon budget when Alistair Darling does his next budget. The whole of government will have a carbon budget. And I think we're going to start thinking that our currency is carbon, not just cash. And I think that will change very much the way we think about policy.
That was Steve Webb, the Liberal Democrat Shadow Secretary for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And here's Norman Baker MP, former environment spokesman, now in charge of transport, who had just finished getting his Fast Track Britain paper on public transport successfully passed in the main conference hall when I spoke to him.
And obviously it's pleasing to see the Lib Dems having a commitment to investing in the railways. Is that a new policy or is that something that's been building?
We've always wanted to see increased investment in the railways, but I think what this paper does today for the first time is put flesh on the bones and say exactly how what we would do and how we would pay for it. And essentially there are two main proposals. The first proposal is a firm commitment to the creation of a high-speed rail network in Britain, both to relieve congestion on existing lines, including for freight, but secondly also to aid economic development. And of course, actually, there's a third reason, which is very important, which is to divert people away from cars and from planes and thereby reduce carbon emissions by moving them onto an electrified railway, which will obviously be much better in carbon emissions per person. And we think an initial stage will cost £11 billion. We've said how we'll pay for that, which is an increase of £30 on the government's proposed aviation duty for domestic flights, and the introduction of lorry road user charging on a per mile basis, which will, for the first time, capture foreign lorries, thereby helping UK hauliers as well.
How many billions, sorry?
11.
11, over how many years?
Well, it depends how long it takes to build, but we're anticipating that we'll start basically right away. And the 11 billion figure is Network Rail's figure, so we're pretty confident it stacks up.
There was an interesting amendment put forward about nationalisation, which was,
yes,
in the end, ultimately clearly defeated,
yes,
in the hall. Isn't that a kind of no-brainer? Hasn't privatisation of the rail been an unmitigated disaster? Hasn't it just in terms of safety and expense?
No, I don't think it has overall. I mean, it was a disaster to start with, and RailTrack was a hopeless basket case. But we proposed as a party the creation of Network Rail, a not-for-profit company. And Network Rail is far from perfect, but it's a damn sight better than RailTrack was. And the talks are now beginning to stabilise in terms of their performance. And indeed, there's some good actions out there from individual companies. And we believe that a combination of longer franchises and tighter requirements from central government can actually bring about the changes that we require, combining both public accountability and private investment. The indications are that when the train operating companies are given a longer franchise, as Chiltern's been given, they use it well to invest in infrastructural improvements. But we're having the safeguard retained that if they don't perform, then they can have the franchise taken away. So there's a direct incentive in what we do to put the passenger first in a way that the present system doesn't do so.
Mick Taylor, who was moving the amendment, I think he was saying it's costing the government £1 billion at the moment, the rail network.
Well, I'm not quite sure where he gets that figure from.
But would you agree with his assessment that it's costing much more now than it was pre-privatisation?
There was a big splurge in expense which came when RailTrack came on board, and there was a lot of money leaching out to RailTrack shareholders. It's also the case that the rolling stock companies have cleaned up, to be honest with you, which is one of the reasons I didn't mention in the debate today, but we're proposing a track damage charge, reflecting the damage of each rail vehicle. And the heavier the vehicle, the more will be paid by the Roscoes in payment to Network Rail, which obviously would go straight into investment in the railway. So the reality is, in terms of expenditure, it's going down. The government's own figures show rail investment's going down. Investments in cars and motorway widening is going up. And that's, of course, completely the opposite of what people want.
I mean, the danger is that people will feel that their money is just going straight into shareholders' pockets if you invest in the rail.
Well, it's not. What we're doing with the system we're proposing is giving longer franchises, and there'll be a commercial case for these companies then to invest, as Chiltern's doing at the moment in creating a new Oxford-London link, in providing the reopening of Lewis Upfield, Skipton Colne, all these sorts of lines, doubling Exeter to Salisbury. If you've got a 30-year franchise, it starts making sense to do that. And they'll be paying for that. Yes, of course they'll get a return and some shareholders will get some money out of it. But the reality is the alternative is to ask Network Rail to do it from public funds. So the entire cost would fall on the public purse, as opposed to, if you like, only the cost of the shareholder dividends, which isn't very much at all. So it's a much better way of doing it. And also the other aspect is this. Network Rail is barely coping with its job at the moment. And we're already proposing to ask it to do a lot more by growing the network, not just handling the network, but growing it with a high-speed network and reopened lines and so on. The last thing you want to do is then pile onto Network Rail running of the trains as well. That's a disaster.
I mean, I noticed, for example, that a motion was passed earlier on in the conference critical of PFI, saying that PFI isn't necessarily the best value for money in terms of public investment. Northern Rock has been recently nationalised.
Yes.
The trend seems to be going away from relying on private investment.
Well, I don't think Northern Rock is in any way connected with the rail industry, and there's no direct parallel there. And I don't think PFI schemes are directly parallel either. What we're proposing is a tightly regulated rail industry with outcomes determined by passengers, measurable as we go along, and the capacity to remove a train operating company is not meeting passengers' needs. That's an entirely different proposition from Northern Rock or any PFI scheme.
project. Okay, to focus on some positives, because I think it's some really good stuff that should be highlighted about the Lib Dems' transport strategy, which is probably way ahead of other parties. You're going to tax domestic aviation.
Yes.
What other measures do you have to reduce aviation?
Well, aviation is a big problem. It's where the carbon is increasing massively, and it's where the technology lags behind in terms of finding an alternative. So there's a need to deal with aviation very, very firmly. Our proposal, I mentioned a moment ago, is to have an increase of £30 on domestic flights as a surcharge to help fund high-speed rail. The average price of a ticket, a one-way ticket in the UK, has diminished, gone down from £205 in 1997 to £103 today. It's halved. It cannot be sensible that the most polluting form of transport becomes cheaper and cheaper, while the cleaner forms of transport, buses and trains, become more expensive. So redressing that balance is a way of persuading people by price to look at alternatives. And we're already seeing big shifts on the route to Manchester, where rail is now predominating over air in a way it wasn't 5 years ago. And further price incentives and disincentives will, in fact, help that. But that's not the whole story, of course, because a lot more needs to be done. We want to see an emissions charge at EU level to recognise the damage aviation does. We don't think the European emissions trading scheme is sufficient. I personally would like to see an arrangement where, even within the ETS, aviation is ring-fenced, because my fear is, without it being ring-fenced, what will happen is aviation will carry on glibly business as usual, buying up permits from other industry and actually damaging other industries while continuing to pollute. So I think a ring-fenced arrangement for aviation as it comes into ETS is a good idea. There's also the question of living within your means. The government had accepted, I'm beginning to doubt whether they have, that you cannot continue to expand roads indefinitely in order to deal with the problem, because you just generate more traffic. That's been proved by the Satcher report in 1994, I think it was. The same thing applies to aviation. They've got to live within their footprint, and therefore the Lib Dems would rule out any expansion whatsoever of aviation in the South East. We're totally against the third runway at Heathrow. We're against any expansion at Gatwick and Stansted. And we'd only want to see expansion at, say, Manchester if, and this is a big if it could be demonstrated that flights are being transferred from Heathrow to Manchester and thereby eliminating the extra leg from Manchester to Heathrow with a hub arrangement. If you get more flights, you potentially cut pollution. But that's a very, very tight and very limited expansion capacity which we're envisaging. And only if that case is absolutely proven that carbon emissions will reduce. But that's the only consideration we're giving to expansion whatsoever in aviation, and nothing in the South East.
The Lib Dem policy of green taxes, or taxing primary fuel as it comes into the country, does that include aviation fuel?
Well, aviation fuel is a difficult one to deal with, because aviation fuel is regulated internationally, as you know. There's international agreements on aviation, and it's simply not possible to impose a tax directly on kerosene in the way that we would like to do, frankly. International agreements won't allow, which is why we've resorted to other means, such as the emissions charge, the surcharge on domestic flights, which obviously we can do something about. There are other methods as well. We want to separate the single till arrangement at London airports, because there's a huge amount of subsidy, it seems to us, crossing over from retail income to operation for the aircraft. We want to separate that out so they've got to stand on their own 2 feet. So there's lots of things we can do to, I think, bring out the true cost of aviation. And when we do that, it'll go up in price. And we're quite open about that.
And also, it's important to know that you are pressing for aviation emissions to be included in the UK emissions inventory.
Yes.
So that would provide a legal obligation, yes, for that to be reduced in line with all the other sectors in the UK economy.
Yes, that's right.
Just talk about what measures you have in place to encourage a modal shift away from car use.
Yeah.
And specifically how the green tax works in terms of, again, taxing primary fuels as it comes into the country.
What we try and do with our green taxes are there to change behaviour. That's what we've always said. They are not there to raise money for the Treasury, for schools and hospitals, although we obviously want to shift taxation away from goods onto bads. But generally, no, we shouldn't be using green taxation to do something else and give it a bad name. And it's also the case that there's no point in taxing people, hitting people over the head, if they cannot change behaviour. So what we've tried to do is come up with a system in terms of road user pricing, which, first of all, doesn't tax the ownership of a car. We don't object to the ownership of a car. We object to the pollution coming from a car. And we've tried to then focus our attention on those journeys where there is a realistic alternative, where people, if they're driving, really should pay for it, as opposed to those journeys which, frankly, are unavoidable. And this is against the background, of course, of increasing fuel prices. Fuel prices aren't going to go down. The long-term trend is quite clearly up. And we've got a lot of poor people in rural areas who will see increasing fuel prices over the years. And I think a sensible policy is one which tries to stabilise that whilst penalising heavily those who use gas guzzlers and use routes where there are rail alternatives. So, for example, we're proposing motorway and trunk road pricing only, and that will be offset. It will be revenue neutral for the average motorist. We're not trying to take more money. That will be offset by an abolition entirely of VED, except for lorries, will be the EU minimum, which is a legal requirement, and by a reduction to the fuel duty by about 10%. And the charge per mile on the motorways will be based on the emissions of the vehicle. So although we will have abolished VED by that point, we'll use the VED bands to determine how much is paid per mile by the vehicles. So if you're going to drive from London to Edinburgh up the M1 and up the A1, and you're going to do so in a gas guzzler, then we're going to get a lot of money from you. But if you're going to drive in a clean car from one village to another in Scotland, then you'll pay less than you're paying now, and that's the way it should be.
Have you looked at the coach network that both the Zero Carbon Britain and George Monbiot have been pushing? Setting aside one of the lanes of the motorway for an expanded coach network, a revitalised coach network.
That doesn't feature in the paper, but we're not against coaches where they can be the best environmental alternative and where they are a sensible mode of transport. What we wouldn't want to do is to have coaches competing in a way that undermine the finances of the railway. First of all, because the railways are by and large cleaner than the coaches will be. But nevertheless, coaches have a role to play, and I'm certainly happy to look at specific proposals. I think it'd be wrong to come up with a blanket policy on motorway lanes, but there may be specific occasions on the motorway network where that policy makes sense.
You're very critical of the deregulation of the buses. I mean, I kind of know how popular the buses are in London, but how nobody rides them in Bristol, where I come from, because they've been deregulated. And so you've got this policy about helping local authorities regain control over some of the aspects of buses.
Let's see what's happened since 1986. Bus prices have gone up way above inflation. The amount of money spent by councils on buses has gone up way above inflation. The number of bus services has declined dramatically, and the profits from the bus companies have gone up. That is not a successful outcome of deregulation. And the fact that London has bucked the trend, albeit with considerable public investment, demonstrates a system whereby local authorities, in this case the Mayor and Transport for London, have some control and can set the routes and set the fares, is one which generates higher bus usage. And outside London, there's been virtually no success in increasing bus patronage, apart from the odd examples, Brighton, Hove, Cambridge, York, Oxford, mainly student centres, as a matter of fact. And that's a disaster, and it's not worked. We've got to change that. Now, the government's local transport bill goes some way to recognise that, but it's too timid. It starts moving down the road of making quality partnerships and quality contacts easier. It doesn't go nearly far enough. So we want to make it easier for local authorities to get back control on the route structure of the buses. We've no objection to private companies running buses. They do so perfectly well in London, but the structure should be determined, we think, by local authorities.
Perhaps you could just comment on there's a proposal for the combined Department of Environment, Energy and Transport.
Yeah.
What advantages do you think that would have?
This is a long-standing Lib Dem policy. We think it's essential to make environment a big player at the cabinet table, and to be frank, DEFRA is not a big player. Although it's well-intentioned and has some good ideas, you put DEFRA in a boxing ring with the Treasury, and it's not a surprise what the result is. A heavyweight against a flyweight is a very early knockout of DEFRA. And we need to change that. So an advantage of bringing environment, energy and transport together is to produce a big player at the cabinet table. Secondly, there is naturally a cohesion between those three topics. If we're going to tackle environment, Hilary Baird may be responsible for polar bears, but he's not responsible for energy generation or for transport. And he can't pull the levers as necessary to deliver the goods. So you've got to put that in one department. And when we had DETR under John Prescott in 1997 for 3 or 4 years, we suddenly saw the beginnings of some more sensible transport policy, because people in the DETR had to clear with their colleagues on the environment side what they were doing. And the policies became more radical, more green, more sensible. And that was demolished when the government abolished DETR. But there's an example of putative of what might have been achieved.
That was Norman Baker MP, the Lib Dems' Shadow Secretary of State for Transport, bringing our look at the Lib Dems' policies to a close. For more information on the detail of the party's energy and climate change policies, take a look at their Zero Carbon Britain paper. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. To catch up with other programmes in the series, visit our archive of programmes at www.climateradio.co.uk. Thanks for listening.